Hello everybody, can everybody hear me at the back? Yes, good, nodding. And we're going to kick off because we've got quite strict times today, so we need to finish at 11:50, we need to finish on time. This session is on surveillance, whistleblowing and free speech in the UK. I just want to warn people that there may be people who will come in and take photos or film. We've asked if you don't want to be in any photographs, if you can either get out the way if you see a photographer, or you might want to sit at the back. It should be fairly obvious if anyone comes in. So I will get started. So in September, it was revealed that the Met Police had accessed the phone records of the Sun's political editor, Tom Newton Dunn, without his knowledge, to find the source of the Andrew Mitchell Plebgate story. And what they'd done is they'd used the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, RIPA, to do this. To circumvent the journalistic privilege to protect sources. And that's normally protected under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which requires that the police would have to go to a judge in order to access a journalist's sources. By using RIPA, they could get internal sign-off. And since then, there have been more revelations about how the police are using surveillance laws to access journalist information. So really, we want to, in the session, we want to ask, you know, to what extent is this happening? And what does this mean for the free speech in this country, for the freedom of the press? So I'd just like to introduce the panel. This is Jodie Ginsberg, who is the chief executive of a brilliant organisation called Index on Censorship, who I should give the disclaimer I used to work for. And they are an international organisation. They promote and defend the right to freedom of expression. Before Jodie joined Index, she worked for the think tank Demos, and she's also a former journalist. She was a bureau chief for Reuters as well. Duncan Campbell is an investigative journalist, author and television producer. He specialised in privacy, civil liberties and surveillance issues. He was the first journalist to reveal the existence of GCHQ back in 1976 in an article that led him to being prosecuted by the government. And he himself has been the subject of surveillance and had his home raided on more than one occasion, I believe, by the police and security services. So he has, can talk very knowledgeably about sort of a personal experience of experienced surveillance as a journalist. Rachel Oldroyd is the managing editor of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and that's a not-for-profit organisation which carries out journalism, which is a public benefit. And the Bureau recently filed a case at the European Court of Human Rights challenging the UK government on its routine use of surveillance of journalists' communications. So we've been hearing more about that from Rachel. She's also an award-winning journalist who previously worked at the Mail on Sunday before joining the Bureau. So, and I am Pam Coburn. I am the Communications Director at Open Rights Group, and I'll be chairing today's session. So I'd like to start with Rachel, and as I mentioned, you're taking the government to the ECHR. I mean, that decision was made before the revelations about Tom Newton Dunn. So what prompted the Bureau to take this action?
So we came to this whole debate of surveillance, of mass surveillance of citizens about 3 years ago. This was pre-Snowden revelations, and we were working with WikiLeaks and Privacy International, looking and analysing the technology available to surveil mass populations. And we looked at it from the perspective of rogue states. So we were looking at how Syria, or the type of technology that was available to the Syrian government to actually look at all the communications of all their citizens. And it was slightly head in the sand stuff, because we never really turned our focus to our own governments and asked the question, well, how is this technology being used by the UK government or the US government? And then along came the revelations from Snowden, and suddenly the realisation that actually, you know, everyone was at it and everyone's communications were being scooped up and analysed and assessed. And we started thinking about this, and we started thinking about, well, what impact does this have upon journalism? And we started to work with a group of lawyers, Gavin Miller QC, and Rosa Curling from Lee Day, and Conor McCarthy from, he's now at Moncton. And they started to go through the legislation and in terms of what was revealed by Snowden. And we started to sort of assimilate this and really think about it, and we suddenly realised that the devastating impact of the Snowden revelations is that journalists can no longer offer any anonymity to their sources. So whether or not we are being surveilled doesn't matter. The very fact that we know the authorities have the capabilities that have now been revealed by Snowden mean we would be wrong as journalists to say to someone we can offer them anonymity, because we just don't know whether we can or whether our communications are being surveilled or not. And the likelihood is that they are. So, as I say, the devastating revelation of that was that the devastating realization was that we just could not operate as particularly investigative journalists in the ways that we used to operate. We had to start thinking about every single communication that we made. And so we put together a case with our lawyers, which we've now taken to the European Court of Human Rights. And the reason why we've gone to the EU as opposed to going through the Investigative Powers Tribunal is that the IPT actually admit that they can't rule upon whether our legislation is strong enough to protect journalistic communication. So we've had to go to the EU. And we filed a case asking the court, the European Court of Human Rights, to rule upon whether the legislation, whether the appropriate legislation is in place in the UK to protect journalistic communications. And if the court rules it in our favour, then the government will have to answer that, and we will open a debate about, whether we have correct and appropriate and powerful enough legislation.
So Duncan, would you, as someone who's been the victim, as a journalist who's been the victim of surveillance, how has that impacted on your work? What impact does that have on free speech?
Well, you can't pretend that having your house raided 3 times and the contents stripped and hauled off to Scotland Yard has anything other than a chilling effect. Its principal effect, obviously I'm still here and I'm still going in this area, but it deters others and it deters whistleblowers. Yeah, they got to all my telephone contacts because they tapped my phone from the first time I called GCHQ and said how I'm doing an article. They also followed me around. Got the contact there superbly. Can you not hear? Is that a problem?
Possible for me to speak into the microphone
and make it a bit better for you. Obviously, that's a very easy way of finding your contacts if you're onto the target in advance. But the sea changes in technology, which threaten the proposed sanctity of journalistic sources, have been underway for 30 years. And in particular, the most devastating and dangerous were being planned and being implemented long before we heard of Al-Qaeda or, in the contemporary reinvocation, ISIS out in Saudi Arabia. These are not the triggers. They go for the data as soon as it's available. And that really creates a new form of existential threat, which is far, far beyond examples like Mr. Newton Dunn, which in a sense, actually to me, are almost trivial in terms of the scale of what can be done. The changes started when our phone instruments started being automatically used to record the call data, the so-called metadata. And that has been, first instance, up to about 2000 in this country, it was, please give us it. And there was no obligation of the companies to hold it. There was just a bit of pressure on them to generate it out with their business and to make it available in Quest. The 2000 Act made it compulsory for the data to be provided and set a platform for the companies to create the databases of who had called who and to make that available to the police or other authorities on a formulated request. No one at the time thought to put any special protection in or to point out whether this was actually compliant with the provisions for the protection of journalism or other fundamental rights. The next thing they wanted to do was to get that data instantly to the police. So the companies had to create direct access services where the police filled in the forms, and unknown to the companies is what data they took, they would get that and download it. Now, funnily enough, I've worked on the other side of the process because I spent 10 years working Montaigne is working as an expert in the courts. So they just found me and said, hey, you know about surveillance. And instead of suing me, the lawyer started paying me, and very nice it was too. And as a result of that, in many terrorists and other sorts of cases, I've had this data obtained under RICO, the sort of set that gave me Newton down. I've audited their procedures, I understand them. I don't like the generality of individuals, but actually in my own personal experience on that side, I never saw them step out of line. Of course, if they were using it in a case to find out journalists are reporting, they're just not going to show it to the lawyers. But the sea change is the one that occurred in the United States after 9/11, and which we have to assume has happened here. We don't see it yet in the reporting, and we know why. Because the vicious jackboot that came down on the Guardian's offices and on the David Miranda when he travelled through Britain is intended to deter others where journalists are otherwise going to be free and not sort of compliant in the way that most of the press is. They wanted all the data now, not just on demand, but made available centrally the whole time. And this is where I have to say, Aaron, I think most others and specialists in the field didn't get it until we started looking at the Snowden papers. The words you have to focus on, they're used by the GCHQ outgoing director recently, Mr. Lawman, they need data at scale. That means taking everything, recording everything. But it doesn't just sit there waiting for an inquiry. If they're following the American model, they're doing automatically what is called, Americans call it graphing, we call it charting. I started seeing charts back in 2001. They don't look very powerful when you see them for one small network, say around a drug heist. But the Snowden papers reveal that as soon as that data was in, all of the network analysis was done automatically. Who linked to who? And we're not now talking about the one-year access under RIPA that was used to get Mr. Newton Dunn's records or any other similar police case. If the whole of the data is there, the whole communications of a country, this country, every other country that's under surveillance, can be pre-analyzed. So it's not just a question of spotting a source coming to a journalist. If a matter arises for investigation, they've already got all the data about the networks of the journalists and the contact networks of the potential sources. Analysis in these circumstances is trivial. So the existential threat really arises from the scale of data, and that is the basis of what Rachel has said. It's not just that there's a lack of no restraint, but they've already mapped out the universe of social contacts, creating, just take one quotation and I'll pass over. This is from one of the documents describing the internet storage aspect of this. You have separate data for phone and data. The application tracks the user's experience, gathers contact information, contact, and develops summaries of targets. The ability to export the data in a variety of formats and to create various charts assists in pattern of life development. And that's the next stage. We're light years beyond the simple tap on my phone, the simple access to a collection of call data records. We're through charting and graphing. We're into stealing commercial data on credit card transactions, on travel records, mapping it all in, and created a sophisticated level of analysis so that when the question comes up, who leaks this, you already got the entire population placed under suspicion and vulnerable to analysis and exposure.
So would you say really, so essentially the real problem is the blanket surveillance of our communications. So if surveillance had to be targeted, if it required judicial authorization, is that the only way we can tackle this?
That's an excellent way to tackle it, but it doesn't get at the core issue, which is that the global network of SIGINT agencies, which is almost a supranational, multinational organization with its own objectives, wants to hold all the data. And as soon as that data is there, you just have to look at what really happened as opposed to what we were told about checks and balances. Mm-hmm. to realise that a single judicial authority to go and get the data would be good in the policing context, but if that data is still there at the higher level and is analysed without warrants by GCHQ's crime analysts, for example, or their security analysts, we have no protection at all. So it is reaching into this gut question for the democracies. Human rights is a balancing act. The security people say we have to protect you, and they do. But they don't realise that it is a balancing act in which absolute security, like absolute privacy, is not available. When the GCHQ director annoyed us all by popping up and saying absolute privacy is not possible, yeah, we got it. We knew it. We know the ACHR. The point is, absolute security is not possible. And he has to come out of that wall of secrecy and engage in an open balancing act. The consequence of protecting privacy and liberties, including the ability of people to whistleblow and feel that they may be safe to do so, means eating into the empire of data that they've accumulated. And it's the toughest fight I could imagine.
You mentioned the treatment of The Guardian. Obviously, we saw, you know, computers being destroyed in their offices, yeah, with the arrest and detention of Dave Miranda. And that, you know, the UK had dropped 3 places down in the Press Freedom Index. So presumably these revelations will be about, you know, access to sources will damage our reputation further. Are we in a sort of free speech crisis in the UK? Or are we just...
Can I
Can
we have that?
Yes.
Sorry.
I have to take one.
Sorry, do you want me to repeat the question?
Yes,
sure. So what I was saying is, are we entering a sort of period of crisis for free speech in the UK? We've dropped down 3 places in the Press Freedom Index because of the treatment of The Guardian, because of the arrest of David Miranda, Glenn Greenwald's partner, who was arrested under the Terrorism Act. These revelations about accessing journalist sources can only really damage our reputation further. So I'd like Jodie to talk about, you know, the impact in the UK.
I think we're in a period of crisis for free expression generally globally in the wake of the Snowden revelations and what we now know about mass surveillance and the huge impact that has on press freedom and on journalists' ability to do their jobs and to, as Rachel said, keep safe their sources and protect their sources, which is at the heart of investigative journalism and what makes it successful and what makes it able to hold the corrupt and the powerful to account. What I think is interesting about the way in which the story has developed in the UK is it feels that we've been rather slow to wake up to the threats to press freedom. I've been struck by actually how little coverage or outrage there seems to be, except in certain communities around, for example, the smashing of journalist computers in the basement of a major national newspaper. I mean, the visuals and the optics of that are so powerful, and yet it seems to sort of fade away very quickly in the story. And yet, the police use a terrorist piece of legislation to access the phone records of the political editor of the Sun newspaper, and suddenly we're in a very different kind of dialogue. And I think actually what's been interesting about the way in which the story has developed, I think belatedly the rest of the journalistic community is waking up to the threats from surveillance to press freedom. And that's absolutely essential, because in order for us to challenge and for organisations like Rachel's to really have to get, I think, buy-in, it's really, really important, I think, that the rest of the journalistic and media community understands implicitly the threats from mass surveillance. And that means that every editor, every journalist needs to be really cognizant of the dangers and the difficulties posed by surveillance, which means we need much better education of the risks. We need much better use of digital tools to protect journalists and protect sources. And we need a much more open and honest dialogue about how the government and how the police are using information and accessing information. And I think
that's something that is happening belatedly but is starting to happen, and you are seeing many more organisations now. It's interesting, I was reading something that Janine Gibson, who is the US editor of The Guardian, and she was heavily involved in the Snowden coverage, and she said one of the problems with sort of talking about this issue is that you often get seen as the tin hat brigade, and I'm looking at you all and hoping that you're not seen as the tin hat brigade, because that's why I think it's difficult for this kind of issue to get traction. It's seen as a sort of special interest, conspiracy theorist madness, when actually it has huge implications for all of us as individuals. It's not even just an issue for journalists, and I think what we need to do is move it out of a discussion amongst, or seen to be held amongst, the Tin Hat Brigade, or even seen to be held just amongst the journalistic community, which frankly is not the most trusted group of individuals in the UK, but use the power that the media can have to help people understand why this has implications, as Duncan said, not just for journalism, but for all of us as individuals and our freedoms that we feel that we've, you know, that we take for granted, I think, often.
Do you, obviously, yes, all of a sudden, lots of other news organisations are interested, but do you think that journalists care about the sort of surveillance of every citizen, or do they just care about the surveillance of journalists?
Speaking as a former journalist, I think we tend to be often quite a self-interested group. I don't think that's unusual to journalists. I think many professions are fairly inward-looking. But I think actually that's a pretty good start. It would be a good start if journalists thought much more carefully about how they're protecting themselves and much more aware of how their how their information is being transmitted, who they're talking to, how they're talking to them, and the implications of that. And I think organisations that deal on a daily basis, particularly with foreign journalists, foreign correspondents, foreign sources, are much more acutely aware of this. And so they're at the sort of forefront, if you like, of dealing with this. But I do feel that that is beginning now to morph out and into the wider journalistic community. I don't know if Rachel would agree with
something. I think now that we've got organisations like Associated Media and News Group talking about this is quite helpful, but they're still very focused on what happened to their journalists by the police. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. No one has started talking about, in the bigger media, talking about Beyond the Guardian, that is, talking about GCHQ and our security services. So we're still very much about how the police can access our metadata, as our communications data, as journalists, to look at one single case that they are investigating. But as Duncan said, we've gone so much further than that. We are now, this is done routinely. Our data is collected routinely, and it is analysed routinely. There is no, it's sort of looking for needles in haystacks that they've got all this information. It's not a case of investigating a specific crime that they can then go and get signed off with a warrant. You know, I think all of us sat here would probably accept that we are trying to fight, you know, there has to be tools to fight terrorism, and those tools maybe are appropriate, but there has been no debate about whether, and there still is no debate, even though we've got the big news media now involved on a small scale, there is still no debate about whether the security services should collect all our data en masse and analyse it, or all our metadata en masse and analyse that. And that's the question that people just don't seem to be getting hold of. And to take it beyond journalism, I mean, I think the thing is that for journalists it's quite easy to talk about the problem and how it affects us. But if we start talking about that in the press, then that quickly gets widened out, because you can't have the debate about protection of journalist sources without having the debate about what the security services are doing, and that will open it out into a debate about how that, whether that is appropriate, you know, per se.
Okay, thank you. I mean, there has been a response by the government. It's more than there was to the Snowden revelation. Certainly, you know, they've said that there was going to be, the Lib Dems have called for a new public interest defence. The Culture Secretary said last week that there would be a Conservatives plan for the British Bill of Rights, which includes special protections for journalists. They're going to review. Do we actually believe that these, well, do we believe them, and do we believe that these reforms will be enough to protect journalists?
It was slightly encouraging to see the responses when Newton Dunn's case was highlighted. It suggested that the political power of that particular media organisation, as opposed to The Guardian, was enough to persuade the government to do something. And what is the something they might do? They might intervene in the process for authorisation of access to telephony records and make it the requirement that, as is the case with search warrants, a judge has to sign off. Now, that's a significant improvement, but it hardly gets into the haystack of what they're really doing. If you go back to when I was raided, there was no requirement that a judge had to say, hey, a journalist's involved, therefore there must be special protections. It's the same if a lawyer is involved or a doctor is involved. It's not that you can't go search them, and that actually must be right. It's that you must go to that high-level protection judge or high court judge. That works to a degree. The thing is, it just doesn't work with the big collection of data that sits behind in the intelligence and security services. So to slightly correct Rachel, it's not just about the police access. It's about what the security service, rather than GCHQ in this case, does. And if it's about a government interest or a big government contractor, you know, one of the, like the people who deal in Saudi Arabia, there's going to be a state interest in getting that data out. Now, we can say at the police level, don't go and get it. Don't go and get it without the judge or high court judge, and if you were any of us on the panel, you would want a high degree of transparency and accountability, as well as that senior and independent judicial person reviewing the prima facie case and giving or rejecting the authority. But the problem is the big graphing data, the charting data, the pattern of life analysis, the charting analysis of everyone in the country that the FBI have done and coupled into what they now get from the internet companies. You've got to assume, not least on the basis of what Edward Snowden said, that it's not just the same here, it's going to be worse. And because of what we talked about with the computers, that story is just not coming out. That's very, very serious indeed. How do we get to that? Well, you know, you could imagine we'll fly some judges into Cheltenham. Yeah, pigs might fly into Cheltenham. I think we can certainly ask for it, given the political initiative. It could be an improvement. You can deal with this in an open, honest debate, which GCHQ and, of course, the others do not engage in because of their, by saying, all right, hold all the data, if you really can persuade everyone's right. But we have the fiercest controls, the nastiest penalties, and anyone who breaches that is going to be caught by some transparency and audit and punished. Parachute judges into Cheltenham, I don't know.
I think at the heart of this has to be transparency. There was a very interesting case in the Investigative Powers Tribunal last week, which was, again, about quite a niche subject, but it's very, very relevant to this whole debate. It was about privileged communications between lawyers and their clients. And these lawyers had been working on a case, which is actually separately in the High Court. It's a terrorism case. And they'd been working on this case, and they started to realise that actually they thought that their communications with their client had been accessed. Now, this is privileged information. You know, the authorities should have absolutely no right to this. So they went to the IPT, and which is the court that assesses any case that you want to bring against the security services, and they asked the government to reveal what policies, not what they did, but what policies they had in place that allowed security services, and at what points the security services were allowed to access privileged communications. And the government said, no, that is state secret material. We will not allow you to know what policies we use. There is absolutely no transparency whatsoever. So, I mean, finally, they were forced to reveal their policies. And they revealed them not in totality. They basically handed over documents which weren't even redacted. The sections that they felt were sensitive, they summarised. So the lawyers and the public have no sense of how much information was taken out. We've got a summary of these policies. And furthermore, they handed these papers to the lawyers and said the lawyers were not allowed to publish them, and reporters could only report upon the detail of these policies that came out in open court. So this is about policies. They won't even reveal to us how they are accessing this material. If there is no public debate or no transparency, then we have no sense of what is happening.
Just a point of information. Isn't the document
It's
available. It is available.
But
now.
Initially it wasn't going to be.
That's it, That I urge everyone to read that admission to the IPT, because it is staggering, and it just shows, even with all the caveats and what's still being hidden, as Rachel has said, just how lax they have got under the wings of the security that they have over them. Lawyers, I think it's fair to say, were uniformly shocked.
Yes. Everyone who's looked at it is shocked. It's really shocking.
But what we don't have is the similar policies towards journalists in general.
Yeah.
How do we get that?
Again, this question.
I
was actually just going to open it up to the floor now. Does anyone have any questions? I don't know how I'm going to do this microphone. Do you want to shout and we'll see? We should be able to hear you from there.
I'm very glad to be here and to hear what you're talking about. I recognize a lot of the problems, especially in terms of raising awareness to specific cases and getting outside of a specific community. Some of you may be aware of the Boston College oral history of the IRA case. That's my life for the last 3 years. And we believe that the second subpoena in particular was a result of electronic eavesdropping of privileged communications between my husband, the researcher, and Boston College's lawyer. We also believe, that I found what you had to say, Duncan, kind of confirming a belief that the whole INLOT request itself was initiated in order to give the legal cover for the police to have access to what the security services already had access to. In other words, the whole case that we're fighting has been a farce from the beginning. And the protection of sources is paramount in this. And the chilling effect that our case in particular has had goes past the academic community into the journalist community. I mean, how can you study terrorism? How can you study sociology? How can you study any kind of controversial or sensitive topic if you can't guarantee the confidentiality of your sources? And this is why this fight's so important. So my question is more of a plea. Can we get help specifically on our case to raise it or connect it to this issue, because it very much is part of the digital or the surveillance issues as well, and the electronic issues. We need help on that. And what else can we do to sort of make the common ties and work together to raise this awareness out?
Firstly, I'm happy to talk to you separately about how we might sort of do more to raise awareness of that particular case, because I completely agree with you. I think also you raise a very interesting point about, and it's one of the things that I think we struggle often with as journalists or in the media, is how to take it outside of journalism. And I think if we can make those connections and show that it is not just journalists who are often seen to be sort of set somehow a kind of separate entity to the rest of the community. It's not just journalists who are affected by surveillance and mass surveillance and abuse of the Secret Service's powers. It's also academia. You know, these things that are vital to democracy, they're vital to a free society. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I think sometimes what happens in the UK is we sort of focus on what's happening here, and it's difficult, and we don't pay enough attention to what's happening internationally. But actually, what's happening in the UK makes it very, very difficult for us, for example, as an organisation, to go to other countries and start talking about how they're abusing surveillance powers. You know, how do you go and talk in Turkey about how Turkey is abusing surveillance powers, or how it's abusing the freedom of the press, when we are behaving in exactly, or in, sorry, not in exactly the same way, but we are behaving in a way that inhibits press freedom in the UK. And I think that's really, really important, is to continually challenge the UK government, the US government and others to behave by standards with which we would expect to see in any other country, because otherwise it makes it incredibly difficult for us to take this argument to places where the repercussions of surveying journalist activity are much, much more severe.
Do we have any other questions?
You put a lot of the onus on journalists to expand the remit of this discussion from journalistic surveillance to mass surveillance. But isn't it the media proprietors who, that's the decision of their interest? They don't want their journalists surveilled, but they really don't give a toss about the rest of the media.
You could probably say the same about politicians as well. I mean,
yeah, and sorry, very quickly, I don't disagree with that, and don't misunderstand me. I'm not putting all of the onus on this on journalists at all. And actually, the definition of what a journalist is and who is imparting information and how, you know, it's also the responsibility of organisations like Index. It's also the responsibility of the activist community, and it's down on the responsibility of politicians. And I know there's a session later about how we make sure that politicians understand this stuff better, because the level of ignorance amongst the people who are setting policy and are supposed to oversee the activities of our security services is pretty woeful, right?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to respond to that? Yeah. Any questions?
I wanted to say in response to that the logical argument seems to be that security or privacy is always a team sport, that if you're a politician who doesn't want to be spied on with the security services, if you ever communicate with people who aren't politicians, it must be in your interest for those people not to be surveilled as well. Because it doesn't matter how off limits your end of the conversation is, if their end of the conversation is fair game. And maybe that's the way we can articulate an argument to everyone who's self-interested in this, is to say, if you ever talk to anyone who's not the press, you need everyone else's communications to be as well protected as your own.
Interestingly, that was the argument was used by Mick Creedon, who said that when they were looking into whistleblowers, they were looking at the corrupt police officers, not the journalists. So his argument was, when we're not looking at journalist sources, it's just the journalist source happens to be corrupt, so we can't, you know.
There's one elephant in the room, which is the parallel construction method. Parallel construction is what the lady was commenting, that the security service has access to information for deep background, for what we journalists call deep background. And we have to respect our deep background, and I respect the deep background of the security services, but the parallel construction is everything that we're doing through the judicial system. We should be doing through a political level to say, first, is this surveillance needed, and can we discuss how surveillance happened and how mass cross-indexing of things happened to begin with? And that's one elephant. And the other elephant in the room is who has access to that. And it's not just protecting the journalists, like he said, it's protecting everybody. Because there's no point saying, as a journalist, the only way is to speak with another journalist, with my doctor, with a politician, or with my shrink. Anybody else is available. Mm-hmm. So there are two discussions. One is political, and the other is judicial. And unless we take the elephants apart, if we're talking about the same thing, the parallel constructions is what they use to prove in court something. We're denying interest to people in the UK on the basis of information that we cannot prove in court. That's a political decision. It's not a judicial problem.
Corey's point is interesting, but it in a sense it echoes the cultural difference across the Atlantic, in which it seems almost universally accepted if you just throw out the idea of, well, what have you got to hide? And most of our politicians, unfortunately, would fall prey to that. There is a sense that in America, the last thing you do is trust anyone in Washington, and therefore the cultural position produces more challenges, and maybe that's why we've got somebody coming out of the NSA, and we've never had anyone of any huge significance coming out of GCHQ and giving information. Parallel construction has been mentioned, and it ought to be mentioned, but it hasn't, with respect, been completely defined. And yet it is perhaps the most sinister of the new developments. You've got these organizations, multinationals, Turkey's included, that's one of the problems. 40 or 50 countries are directly tied into this, including the whole of Europe, secretly, without the knowledge of the legislature. One big system that's turned the internet into a surveillance territory of unimaginable proportions. They get all this data. They're tasked on terrorists. Yeah, we all support that, no problem there. But they want to do more stuff with this data now that they've got it. They've got us all mapped out. Hey, why can't we just intervene with computer hackers? And we know they've done this with the activist computer, with the hacker community. They've used the power of their networks to attack these really rather trivial targets. I think we all damn well care if someone lets off a bomb. But I don't think we are, as a society or individuals, as concerned if some big corporation which has caused offence by some trivial action comes under a little bit of non-state cyber attack. But they've turned to that. They've turned to serious crime. And again, large cocaine or whatever importation conspiracies are a subject of concern. Policy may be debatable, but the law is clear. So they want to move into that turf. And what has systematically happened over the last decade is how do we migrate this data down while hiding it? Because the thing that GCHQ and NSA most want to do is that no one should know what they're doing. This creates a problem as soon as you start to permeate or infiltrate data into the legal system to achieve action. You can tip off the police and hope that they find some alternative data with which to bring a prosecution. And that is now well established in the United States, and I think there have been indications, even in GCHQ's material, that that's happening too. So they've analysed the communications, and then they tell the cops to go raid. If the cops don't find any drugs, oh well, sorry. If they find the drugs, then the drugs are ex post facto, the justification for the raid. But you are immediately in the situation of which the American colonists rebelled against. General search warrants, are we found something, we'll do you. The problem is that while that seems okay for one individual, shall we say, serious crime falling short of terrorism, it imposes a massive blanket of chilling and fear across others who might want to speak out, warn of abuse or whatever. So the parallel construction is explicitly labelled as such in the United States. It's been developed, it's in the literature, you can find some Snowden papers on it. And it is simply this, how do we lie to the courts? We've got a big surveillance empire, we want to bring the stuff into court, so we have to conceal where it came from. And you are completely up against the rule of law there. I'll just say, I'll be very pleased to talk to you afterwards.
Great. I'll take some questions. Can I get the lady at the back?
Do you have any practical advice for journalists how to
Did everyone hear that?
Yeah, this is my first one. Not tin hats, but tin boxes. You're going out on a job, turn off your smartphones and put them in there. I'm serious. I do that now. But there are specific tools. Some of them are porridge and horrible to use. Some of them work quite well. The point is, you have to do the risk and the threat assessment. If you're dealing with something that is a substantial or significant interest of the state and its intelligence and security agencies, then you have a very tough fight indeed. But if you're investigating a pollution story or the fixing of energy prices, you might be fearful and your sources might be fearful, but the intelligence services under the present system cannot effectively be tasked, nor will they, I believe, volunteer that kind of information to support a small private interest. So when GCHQ was a great Cold War artifact, obsessed with secrecy and regarding cops as people to be despised, the protection of human rights of journalists and others were that they wouldn't talk to each other. But the last 10 years have seen a deliberate attempt, now having created the surveillance apparatus, to bring it in, seep it into everyday policing, but to do so secretly, unaccountably, untransparently, and dishonestly, so far as the court process is concerned. If Snowden has done one thing, it may have slowed that process down. But I would say a lot of stories, a lot of things, you maybe just want to reassure people that the surveillance won't reach out to them. Once you're in the hard area, there are some specific tools. But the problem we really grapple with, suppose there's somebody out there who really wants to tell us something. How do they come? How do they find how to come? How do they find the tools to reach to a journalist safely without leaving a small electronic trace that can be found afterwards? And once you've got this data at scale, that is horrendously difficult to do. The only example we've got of this is Edward Snowden. But Edward Snowden knew the system backwards. And he struggled with the inverse problem. For 3 or 4 months, he tried to get Glenn Greenwald to install an appropriate encryption system. He sent him a tape explaining how to do it. He reached out to 2 or 3 others to say, could somebody just get this guy to pay attention? and even... Glenn has admitted in his book, you know, when he got to Hong Kong, he was still making mistakes. It is horrendously difficult. If you're at the top level and talking to the right people, you can get some effective tools that work. But to reach out to somebody who might have a Snowden-like story to tell and to make information available to them, they've got to know it from the start. The problem is communicating with that kind of source at the beginning.
I do know that Org is going to be actually doing some work with journalists. I believe that we've got a project coming up where we'll be helping people to sort of encrypt their emails, probably not necessarily on the level you're talking about.
Just one.
Yes, sure.
There's a seminar going today in another venue.
I think, yeah, there is. I think there'll be a hacking.
And I think if anyone's really interested in this issue, there's a really brilliant event coming up at the beginning of December run by the CIJ, which is Secrecy, Surveillance and Censorship. And they've got lots of people, including people like Jake Applebaum, talking about precisely this type of thing. So if you go to CIJ website, you'll be able to get details. It's a 3-day conference, and I know that these issues are going to be discussed there.
Get your question up. Yep.
So one of the problems I find articulating this with friends and family is that I think everyone in this room knows that journalism is essential to a functioning democracy, but that has been somehow forgotten. People I speak to. So in the same way that most people I encounter and spoke to didn't understand about single-time terrible vote versus first-past the post, the knowledge about the mechanism of democracy is lacking. And therefore, I'm making arguments about how important journalism is and why surveillance damages journalism without the underpinning of the understanding of why journalism is essential to democracy. So how do we tackle that? I mean, maybe this isn't a problem that you perceive, but it certainly is for me.
Interesting.
I can only just agree, really. I mean, I think one of the big problems we have is that journalism is sort of down in the dirt at the moment, and it's a profession that is, you know, most people just don't think very positively of. So I think we've just got to, as journalists, anyone in the audience who is a journalist, we've just got to keep trying to explain to people why proper journalism is so fundamental to a functioning democracy. But I agree, it's very easy to forget that we've got to tell everyone that again and again.
So there's been there.
If you, I watched the film that came out recently, the Snowden film, etc. Yep. And one of the things that's quite striking is how the American security organisations are often in breathless admiration at how much slack the English ones get. Because there's this kind of implicit trust. As you said, effectively, any great level of concern is seen as the tin hat brigade. What's striking about what you've all said is that there's this long list of people who thought they were special cases. So journalists thought they were special cases and privileged. The lawyers thought they were special cases and privileged. The MPs thought their conversations with their constituents were special cases and privileged. They were all wrong. So two questions. One is, shouldn't you all be talking to each other? Kind of raising the game and saying we were all wrong. We all thought we were the special case and the other two were getting stitched up. It turns out that maybe we all failed to warn each other about the threat to the other guys because we thought one was special. The only other thought was on the lady's point there about because of the level of traffic analysis we have in machine happen. Yes, if you try and talk to someone special, that shows up in terms of the behavioural analysis. So in terms of what you and we could be doing at the moment, maybe do we all have to start behaving suspiciously? In order to provide some background noise to the important stuff.
Well, one problem we have is a major democratic deficit. You may remember that the government was trying to bring through a communications data bill which would modernise this entire area. Many of us, everyone here, I'm sure many of you in the audience, probably engaged with members of Parliament, and the result was spectacular. The Joint Committee on the bill rejected it, leading Nick Clegg at that time to say, this will never pass in this Parliament. Even the Intelligence Services Committee, rather tame, rather placement, had severe criticism. What happened? What happened in 7 days in July was a coup d'etat in this area that's happened before in other countries, driven by the same process. They forced a bill through Parliament without Parliament being consulted. They did it by fixing up a deal with the party leaders, and they all bowed over and said yes. I mean, we panicked. We reached out for all the MPs, the people we've been talking to. Some fell by the wayside. There were probably only two MPs, one in the Tory party, one in the Labour party, who were actually putting, Davis and Watson, putting up serious resistance to this. And it was hopeless. It'd been stitched up in advance and Parliament had sold the pass. No protections for MPs, no protections for journalists, nothing.
I'm afraid. I think that we're out of time. So I'd just like to thank the panel again, Rachel, Duncan and Jodie, and thank you all for some great questions. Thank you. Thank you.